for half hour, 45 minutes, in order to make a picture of the radiation that in your bloodstream as it goes through your heart. And it takes them 45 minutes or so, half hour, to gather enough of that information on this extremely sensitive machine to make that picture. At that lower level, in a couple of seconds, you're near your child. My goodness, that's crazy. It's the same philosophy that every dose is an overdose. Well, when you sit out in the sun on a sunny day on the beach, the amount of heat you're getting from that is 1,000 times greater. And so this is super conservatism, and it's a lack of understanding, and it's again that that emotional word radiation. Back to you, Mel.
This takes the cake. Well, yeah, we can go on and on with this and all, but that is what has come up in the last 2 years. Like you say, it's gang mode, you know, mentality. That's let's gang up on them, and that's it. And as far as, well, you go to a dentist now, you see precautions they take now. They put this nice, heavy, so-called leather jacket they drop over you when they x-ray your teeth. And I see the dentist, he walked away about 10 feet now. And I'm saying to myself, I remember when I was repairing x-ray machines for dentists, and I was taking those heads apart, and taking out, first of all, handling that oil. It was that PVC oil. And then fooling around with those replacing those tubes in there with the thing open stick. How many of those x-ray machines I worked on, you know, and took them apart, repaired the head, repaired the power supplies and all that stuff, and never saw twice, you know. Well, you went to the dentist's office, you know, in those days, those machines, no doubt, put out a lot more rentings than what is available today. I mean, they have the low dose, of course, film and everything that's easily exposed with low dose of x-rays. But can you imagine? So I'm surprised I don't glow in the dark now over
WQEL repeater system. And there are people who used to think that colored television sets with the 30 kilovolts was emitting a lot of x-ray. Well, there's a heavy piece of glass up front that's supposed to give you protection. But the person who's working behind the set on the high voltage cage, people used to worry about the dust becoming radioactive. The dust that you've got on that set isn't the right kind of material that can absorb any of that energy. And those are rather soft x-rays that come out of a color television set. 30 kilovolts is an extremely soft x-ray. The x-ray machine that's x-raying your teeth, I think, is either running on I think it's 300 kilovolts. I believe it's a 300 kilovolt supply. And that's a considerably harder x-ray. But it's only with modern day equipment, it's only a fraction of a second. My dentist now puts an object in your mouth, which collects the x-rays. It's a mosaic that collects the x-rays from the external source, the x-ray tube. And he's got a picture on the computer screen 2 seconds later. KQKEY, KQRIW.
I know they all have this, but going into that new piece of equipment, I saw it in my dentist's office also. Well, anyway, the x-rays, that's another situation that I had. I was working for Zenith when all that hullabaloo started. That's another place where the chaotic because of the suits and everything like that. All the politicians jumped on the bandwagon. There were stupid statements that they said because in fringe areas, the man is going to come in, the technician's going to come in, he's going to turn up the high voltage so you're going to have more x-rays. Stupid statements like that. So what do? They gave us this thing to keep it in our pocket. It's what he called the dosimeters. It had a lens on it. You held it up to the light, you had a meter inside there, and it was on, you know, zero, and every so often you take it and they look at it to see if it moves off zero to see what happens with working around color TV. You know what I'm talking about? Remember those dosimeters with the lens and that little gauge inside of it over?
Yes, I own two of those. I own the charging network and two of those detectors. I think they pronounce it dosimeter, but maybe it's dosometer. What that really is, Mel, is it's an electroscope. In other words, suspended in a glass, a pair of glass diaphragms on the left and right side of a metallic tube, is a coaxial structure. The coaxial structure, you charge it to, I think it's 67 volts. The 67 volts creates a electrostatic repulsion of this little whisker, and the whisker moves across a graticule. So you've got a magnifying glass that's looking at this this graduated scale, and this whisker, when you charge it, should be at zero. It's a maximum deflection. As X-rays or cosmic rays or anything else come along that penetrate the tube, it creates an ionized path which slowly discharges that capacitor. It's about a 0.1 picofarad capacitor, believe it or not. It's a very small capacitor. And you charge it up and it stays charged for most of a week. And I think they check it every couple of days or so. And so it tells you the total accumulated dose that you've had of a particular kind of X-ray. Now, each of these Geiger counter-like things and dosimeters all have a particular amplitude of X-ray that they're sensitive to. And so if your X-ray is much softer than that, it never penetrates the tube, never gets a chance to discharge that little semiconductor of the coax that's got the whisker. And the whisker is being deflected by electrostatic repulsion. When you've got two little gold leaves, so to speak, with the exact same charge on each one, they repel each other, and that creates a deflection. So that's the way that dosimeter works. I own one of those. And it's kind of a fun machine. It's amazing that you can get a tenth of a picofarad capacitor to store 67 volts on it for that length of time. The leakage resistance inside that capacitor has got to be probably 10 to the 15 ohms. I could calculate that one. Back to you.
Roger, this is KQR. Yeah, I know they had that cool gadget there that had to stick it on and the light came on. And also, like you say, reset it. I think we had a 90-volt peak battery. For some reason, I remember a 90-volt peak battery there. Push the button and reset it or whatever. I don't know, whatever the heck they did with it. But I never heard of anybody that moved. So, it's just like to say, a lot of chaos, because then they have to come up with a gadget. They have to modify all the color TV sets that were out in the field and install. They said that there was some kind of a network in there that they, I remember it was a four-leaf type, looked like a capacitor, a big orange capacitor, that you had to install to put it in there so that the high voltage couldn't be turned up beyond a certain point, and blah, blah, blah. They remember they enforced that, it created a lot of work going back to all those sets that were out there in the field and modifying them. It cost the Zenith at that time a pretty buck to, cost all the goddamn companies, not only Zenith time, of course, it's all American. Zenith, RCA, Sylvania, SoCal, all of them out there have to go through that whole routine to put this thing in there to prevent it, whatever the heck it was. I don't remember how the circuit worked, but I remember it was a four-leaf orange, looked like a big capacitor. Like a condensed, like it looked like a 0.5, 600 volt capacitor with four wires on it with orange colors take over.
Roughly what year was that taking place, Mel? I was doing radio and television repair from roughly 1956 to 1964. And out in rural Suffolk County, not much of that took place. Sounds to me like that was mostly a New York City ordinance of some kind. And roughly what year was that taking place, Mel?
It was in the 60s, you're right. Let me see. I came out of the service, and I went to work at the Zenith place, that time, Zenith Company, and they were located in the Village, New York City. It must have been about 62, 63, 64, 65, say about 3 years or so. So within that period of time. And no, it was not New York. The Zenith had to notify. It was a federal something with the federal government that demanded that Zenith had to send everyone who purchased the set had a Zenith Color TV set, like all the others, they have to send a registered letter with a return, you know, they had a sign for it to people to make sure that they got it, the, you know, registered letter, return receipt, and that they have to make an appointment with their local authorized Zenith service company to mandatorily make this change. And let me tell you, some of the people, they were real cute. They were real funny. I mean, they would laugh. It was serious, but it was laugh how they, one woman got on the phone. She said, I paid so much money for this TV, she was telling me. I said, yeah, well, we're taking care of it and everything. We'll take care of it. She says, and now you tell me there are radios in my TV. I bought a color TV. What are you telling me there's radios in her TV? She went on and on about what, how did they get a radio into the TV set? Uh-oh, I mean, this is just, you know, one of the stories I remember, but there was one service guy told us that he got to the house and they thought the television was going to explode. So this is so funny, Dick, I got to tell you a story real quick. They turned their couch on its side, and they were hiding behind the couch, cowering behind the couch over the weekend, and taking turns watching in case the set started to, was off the set, going to blow up or do something, so they could alert the other one while they were sleeping. They were taking turns so they could get out of the house, Dick, over.
Boy, is that a strong misunderstanding of what was going on. Wow. It's a lack of education and misinformation. And so, from what you can tell, the brochure that came with that four-leaded item from, let's say, Sylvania, Philco, Admiral, Zenith, these are the major brands, Dumont, RCA, these are the major brands in that day. Did the brochure that come with it, did it have a reasonable explanation from your point of view?
Well, the only thing came with it, I remember, trying to picture it, a lot of years ago, it came in a little box. It had a tie strap, a little one tied to hang it on to something. I don't remember, it was the edge of the chassis or something, and then four wires, and just the installation way of installing it, but I don't remember what the explanation is. All I know is with that thing is installed, supposedly you couldn't crank the high voltage up at that time, which was their supposedly cutoff point, was about 27.5, I believe, Dick, over.
Yeah, somebody was coming to the conclusion that by the time you hit 30 kilovolts, the x-rays are becoming hard enough that if you put your head right in front of the screen and stayed there for hour after hour, you'd be up above the threshold of alarm where you could possibly do yourself some damage. Somebody must have come to that conclusion. And later on, I think they put a very heavy piece of lead-bearing glass as the safety glass in front of the tube to protect you from that. I'll bet you the much later set were using 30 kilovolts to make sure you had enough brilliance. You would like to set the high voltage up toward 30 in order to get enough brilliance. When you're down at 27.5 kilovolts, you're at the threshold where you're almost starting to balloon out the picture, if you know what I mean. You don't get as much intensity as you'd like to get, particularly due to the fact that the phosphors in those days were not as sensitive as modern-day phosphors. Almost all of this is now becoming moot because we're all slowly getting rid of kappa ray tubes. We're all using flat-screen, liquid crystal light display devices. Back to you, Mel. Thank you, LAW.
Is that right? This is how that this started. That's exactly. You almost hit it on the nail on the head, as they say. How did it start? Somebody somewhere got this brilliant idea that he took a photographic plate and he put it up against the screen of the television set, and then when he developed it, he saw an image on it. And that's how he figured out that the only way that to expose that image on that plate, that photographic plate, was because of the radiation. Here we go with the radiation coming off the screen. And so on and so forth. And from there on, like you say, they had to increase the thickness of the front glass. Quite a goddamn picture. Started weighing a ton. And, you know, you ever broke one open, you can see the thickness of that front glass is considerable. So that basically, he started the whole thing, of course, and it got blown out of, you know, like you say, you have to have your nose literally glued to the face of the tube. That's what it is. Started it all just with that one guy with that photographic plate. He has got himself his 15 minutes, as they say, of fame, Dick, over.
Yeah, nowadays, even with a safety glass, there is a significant number of volts sitting on that tube. That's very, very little current. But on that glass in front of the cathode ray tube, my Wimshurst machine, the thing that you saw me making those sparks with when you and I got together during the field day operation, every so often that thing has trouble starting. And I'll take one of its output probes and literally touch the glass with it while the television set is turned on. And after that, it works like a charm. It charges it and starts the process. It primes the pump. I've got a high voltage measuring machine that goes up to 30 kilovolts. I'm going to, later on, one of these days this week, I'm going to put its probe up against my picture tube of my television set in the living room and find out what voltage is there. And I'll bet you I'm going to find something like 15 or 20 kilovolts on the outside glass. And the reason why my electrostatic voltmeter can do that is it draws no current. It works by electrostatic repulsion. Whatever voltage you put on its probe creates very similar to what happens with an electroscope, where you've got those two gold leads that repel each other. Well, there's a very sensitive Dawson valve-like movement inside, where the repulsion of two plates makes the needle rotate, and it's calibrated in kilovolts. And as I said, the machine goes up to 30 kilovolts. I was kind of amazed that there was a local college throwing that out. And I discovered a whole lot of instruments sitting in their dumpster one night, and I started doing a little dumpster diving and came across this beautiful machine, which probably was made in 1950. But can you imagine a machine that can measure 30 kilovolts without drawing one picoampere in the process? K2KEY, K2LIW.
It's a Rio, dude.
Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, on a slightly related subject, Dick, you're about 10 years older than me. In 1963, getting back to the school system, I had a shop teacher, an electric shop teacher, was about 13 years old. I believe he was a ham. I wonder if anybody would have known him. His name was Herb Gallon, like a gallon of milk. I remember he bought, I don't know what it was at the time, but he bought a Tektronix scope in the shop to show the kids what a waveform looked like. I'm probably one of the few kids that cut other classes to spend extra time in his electric shop. And, Dick.
Yeah, I own one of those Flash Gordon probes, they're called. I own a probe made by Tektronix to be used into their oscilloscopes, and the probe goes to 30 kilovolts. It's a great big round object. The handle on it looks almost like the kind of a mechanism you have that protects your hand on a sword. And so it's a big protection device, and inside of there is a multi-megohm resistor, and it measures high voltage, and it will show you the waveform on an oscilloscope. Real fun type thing. But I'm trying to think, I guess it was 1957 or 58 that I took electric shop. And, 1956 is when I took electric shop in Farmingdale and built a Super Heterodyne with 5-tube receiver. Wonder if you ever built a Superhet 5-tube receiver, Mel. In fact, right around that time, I guess within a few months, I bought my Heathkit AR3, which is a 5-tube preceiver, which was both the broadcast band and 80 to 10 meters. That was a kit from Heathkit that cost about $30, $28, some number like that. And when you're up by 10 meters on the thing with a 455 KCIS, the image and the reel response were only about 10 dB apart. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is Jason 1981. Now, one of my best sources of a lot of my goodies came out of some of the diving things, so don't be ashamed. The fact that you mentioned those sensors left when you said those tectonic, old tectonic probes. If you remember those old gray probes that they, the probe was a hefty probe. I mean, it was a good size, you know, that you could get your hand really around on it, that they used in, came with the 535 scope, you know, that whole series, the early series of it. That's what I found. I found a whole pile of them, and the probe, and then the piece, the different adapters that sit on the end of the probe, you know, snapped on. That was the early version of Tektronix when they had that, and then they had that probe that had the rings on it, you know, just to keep your hand from flipping up onto the tip, and a good heavy gray wire that went to the scope. So I have a whole pile of that, Dick, I found that was thrown in the dumpster, literally. And as far as the TV set, well, there must be some electrostatic something going on there, because the screen does get dusty, you notice. That it attracts black dust if you, sometimes take a clean white rag, you go wipe the screen off, you'll notice there's always a, especially I think in the wintertime when the furnace is running, I think it attracts that carbon coming out of the chimney over.
It sure does. That is electrostatic attraction. There are people who used to operate with their nose very close to Kessel Green Tube video display devices on their computer. And some of them, those people, would develop eye irritation. I'm relatively sure that what was going on is the high voltage electrostatic potential that exists on the surface of the video display device is attracting dust, and if your face is very close to it, that dust is also getting close to your eyes, and that's what I think creates the irritation. There's dust in our air all the time, otherwise you wouldn't be getting anything in your vacuum cleaner. I don't know about your house, but my vacuum cleaner picks up quite a bit of stuff. Not all of it was thrown down by human beings. Some of it, you don't know where the heck it came from. And there's a tremendous number of oil-burning furnaces that are very poorly set. When you use the right instrumentation to adjust the flame on an oil-burning furnace, so that the flame is at maximum temperature and you think you're getting maximum efficiency, you absolutely are not. There's a guy named Erwin Dresner. I think it's K2. You probably remember Erwin. He was a popular guy on LIMON for a whole lot of years. So, Rich, when you think of his callers, break in and tell me. So Erwin Dresner accepted a contract from Brookhaven Laboratory, Brookhaven National Laboratory, to measure something like 100 oil burners in people's homes in Long Island, on Long Island. And he found a high percentage of them were set in such a way that they were starved for air and they were making a sooty flame. I've been doing my own oil burner repair and service for 30 years, and I intentionally set the air mixture a little bit on the rich side, so that the flame burns a lot cleaner. Because I'm putting in a little more air than required, I know that my flame is a little bit cooler, but there is no soot on the heat exchanger in my furnace. The soot that builds up on your heat exchanger becomes a very good insulator, and no matter how hot the flame is, the heat is no longer getting to the boiler. The soot that's inside of the flue pipes of my furnace is a light tan color, not black. If you've got black soot in your flue pipes of your oil burner, and you are starved for air, and you're making a sooty flame, and I'm convinced that that is not a safe mixture to breathe, even though it's coming out your chimney, always a little bit of it leaks into your house, and even coming out of the chimney when the wind blows a certain direction some days, a little bit of it from the chimney can get back into the house. So I would much rather have that be a cleaner burn due to higher air content. And the thinking on that is that your nozzle of the oil burner is trying to atomize that oil. It's squirting the oil through an extremely fine hole with a curved path inside, which is swirling the oil at 100 pounds per square inch at very high velocity and is trying to make it into a fine mist. But if you study that fine mist coming out of the nozzle of your oil burner flask tube assembly, it has a Gaussian distribution of oil burner, of oil droplet sizes. And so when you adjust the amount of air for the hottest possible flame, you're giving it enough flame, enough air to burn the median size, the intermediate size oil droplets. The great big droplets of oil, even though they're way down on the Gaussian curve, they are not being properly burned, and they're making soot. Whereas when you make a higher air content mixture, you're burning a larger portion of that distribution of the oil droplet size. K2KEY, KQRIW on the TechNet.
Very interesting. This is K2KEY. Well, we all have, mostly all gas heat here. I don't know if any oil, in fact, I don't know if anybody gets oil delivery. I haven't ever seen an oil truck on the street here. All the new construction, especially here, most of the houses on this block here have been replaced in the last few years. And the only thing they install is gas, natural gas. In fact, the natural gas gadgets that they use now, I got a furnace downstairs, and, you know, I have a chimney and all, you don't see no more chimneys and all. They got just a vent, looks like a dryer vent that they have on the gas dryer. That's it, just a small vent type system. And the gadget that's in the house, I looked at it, that's the heat and all the systems that they use. It looks like an oversized carburetor to me. That's the only way I can describe it. You don't see much in the way of oil heat here in Brooklyn. This natural gas has been around here, it seems like, forever. And it's got to the point where I'm sure that there are still a number of buildings, you know, the apartment buildings, large buildings that are burning oil, but the, I guess that's a different number of oil than used in your home. I should say everybody here is burning natural gas. And, the pipe, you know, the chimney is clean. You know, you look at the chimney, it's clean. It just burns so deep like it burns. Even in my older type furnace, it seems like it burns very clean natural gas. And you asked about, did I do electronics in an early age or something to that sort? Well, I think I was born with a probe in one hand or whatever, a soldering iron or whatever. Because this is the only thing I ever did. I mean, I can remember back, I had, that's it. I never had any other hobbies. I don't know, they did things like build model airplanes and other things like that. Not me. The only thing I did was build radio equipment. And that's it. If it would have been these days, I would have been a ham most like when I was 5 years old or 6 years old, because I was ready for it at that point, ready to use CW especially. But of course, you had to go take the test. When I got my ham license, I had to take the test down at it's called the Friendly Candy Company in New York City on Washington. So I had to wait until I was 13 years old, and that put me off a few years. Otherwise, I would have been most likely an old-time ham by the time I was 13. That's it. Never had any other interests, hobbies, or whatever. And still, I guess, still, you know, my wife looks at me with a funny look. Yeah. Time, well, no, time to go on. Yeah, right. Anyhow, all right, we can just kill the subject and go on to maybe some emails before I get buried in a big over.
Now, what made you wait until age 13 to apply for your license? I've known of hands 5 years of age. Was there at one time a 13-year restriction on taking the FCC license, Mel?
No, then my parents wouldn't let me go on a train. How was I going to get to the FCC? I had to take a train. I had to go to Washington Street. So I snuck away when I was 13. I was brave enough at 13 to sneak away, literally sneak away, and go down to the FCC in New York. Imagine at 13, I was so naive. Please don't even, you know, say the kid at 13 is so worldly. I was really, I guess you can call naive, nerd, naive, or whatever. And finally, I get up to nerd when I'm 13. Well, here I am, a man, officially at 13. You know, you're bar mitzvah, you're a man. So I get up to nerve to actually had enough money saved up in my pocket, I think it was 25 cents at the time, yes, 25 cents to get on the train, and went to the FCC and took my test. Can you imagine that, Dick? Over.
Did you pass it the first time? I failed the code test the first time and had to come back a month later, Mel. Go ahead.
No, I passed. I did pass the first time around, Dick. Like I say, the CW was the easy card, really, for me, because I knew CW since I was four. My father, remember, was a CW operator during World War II, and that's all he ever did, is spend CW. And I guess I knew CW about the same time I learned how to, or maybe before I knew how to talk. I think I recognized CW, Dick, over.
Very good. Yeah, me and my buddy Rob were sending Morse code to each other. We had our own fancy swing in which we were sending the letters very fast with great big spaces in between. And when I heard the machine down at the official machine down at headquarters of FCC, it sounded to me like it was all run together. We weren't smart enough to practice unreal Morse code over the air. We were just sending Morse code back and forth to each other, and we had to develop our own internal style. We soon found out about that real fast and corrected that the next month and came back and did the test again. That was, let me think. I think it was February of 1956. No, March. March and April, I think it was of 1956. All right, back to you, Mel. And you probably ought to get to a little bit of email.
Okay, this is KTUR. Nice reminisce about so-called good old days. I don't know how good they were. They weren't the greatest, but I had my problems. Lots and lots of problems coming from a number of different directions. So I really had a sort of, as they say, fight my way up to wherever I am right now. Which is, all right, not too bad now. I'm tired. And the pressure is off, but it was a tough to get to if you didn't have the resources, the kids today, they sort of, I could say, have it made, and they don't appreciate. But let me put it this way: I never wanted it on my kids to have to go through the struggle. So I guess if anyone was overindulgent, put them with a lot of things, gave them a lot more than that they deserved and everything, but I guess I overcompensated for what I had in life. So they don't realize how much easier life is today. And I should say, even the way things are taught and all, everybody wants everything at a push of a button. This is it. So it's a completely different world today. So I'm sure we're boring everybody to death here, talking about what was the past over.
Yep. But you can easily come to the conclusion, Mel, that things are changing in such a way they're going to the dogs. And as I've said so often, we've been going to the dogs ever since Roman times. And society is going downhill and everything is going to hell in a handbasket. Well, we're not at the kennel yet. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, this is KQKUY. Let's get the email up to the jazz, as you will say. Let's see, here's one. You've got me completely confused. Ah, thank God, we're confusing somebody. You mentioned a number of different loops. First you talked about your outside loop antenna, right? Okay. Then you talked about your indoor loop, and you said you made it with coaxial cable, and then you said you made it with copper pipe. Which is it? All right, I think here's where the confusion came in. Yes, I did make one years ago, as I had said, for a friend of mine that lived in New York City that worked with me, that couldn't live in one of the high rises there and had this little appendage that sticked off his apartment called a patio or some kind of a little outdoor thing that two people could basically just barely fit. And we did make up this thing out of copper pipe, and it was a transmitting loop antenna. Yes, he did use it as a loop, and I did make it, and we did make it out of copper pipe. And it was for 10 through 29. It covered 10, 12, 15, 17, and 20 meters. And it was soldered together. The loop I'm using now, I'm using two loops now. One is the outdoor loop, as I had mentioned, 272-foot circumference loop. And the other one is my receiving loop that I have in the shack. That's for 80 meter, my 80 meter receiving loop. That is made with a piece of coax cable, yes, that is stretched around the wood frame. Not that, so I'd say if there's confusion, we'll talk about three different loops. And the one that I made years ago, one out of copper, yes, was used as a both transmitting and receiving loop. I have been using one I have now stretched around the wood frame as strictly just a receiving loop. I've used it just briefly to try an experiment to transmit into it, but on speedy meters, the conditions are that you got to run more than 100 watts to really do anything on that band, and I'm just not in the frame of mind to have a kilowatt plus next to me with a loop in the shack. So that's where it stands at this point. The loop antenna. Want to add anything to this takeover?
No, I think you've covered it very well. And that loop antenna works so much better, not because it's got higher gain, but because you can tune it in azimuth, elevation, and polarization. And that's the important one. The fact that you can tune it in polarization, and that ionosphere is shifting that polarization continuously. And somehow, that has never been made clear in any of the ham radio literature that you and I read. If you dig deep enough, you'll hear a little hint about the word Faraday rotation. But the fact that every single HF signal you hear that's coming off that ionosphere is continuously rotating multiple times in polarization. Somehow, no one knows about that. And you've rediscovered that with that loop antenna. And man, is that a well-kept secret. K2KUI, K2RIW.
Roger, roger. Okay, let me read over. Here's the stuff again. Here we go with the Aggie and the quads again. Let me just make a quick statement, because I've gotten so many emails that we opened up, I said, Pandora's box when we just mentioned quads, you know, and Yaggies in the same discussion. If you're happy with your Yagi, it's working great. I'm sure it's doing its job. If you're happy with your quad antenna, use it, enjoy it. I'm happy that it's working great and all. And we're not going to pick up on this controversy again. I got a whole thing that, oh my God, I got a whole. It's actually looks like somebody's going to submit this for a theory of something, a theorem that would about trying to prove one thing or the other thing. I mean, this goes on and on. You should have seen some of this stuff with the math and everything they're going through. They're coming at me with daggers because of this, you know, taking either the that we said that the note doesn't seem to be any different, or the gains don't seem to add up at all. These people are really, the quad guys are really, like I say, really out to gang up on us over.
Yeah, and the real difference, if there is one, is a small fraction of a dB. For people who believe there's 2 and 3 dB of difference, even if there was, that's only half an S unit. But the real estate is not that different for the antenna itself. When you go through the process of calculating the effective capture area, it's awfully similar for, let's say, a 3, 4, or 5 element quad. Now, I'll admit that a two element quad will behave better than a 2 element Yagi. But by the time a person really builds a serious quad, he's into at least 3 or 4 elements, and there the difference starts decreasing pretty fast. There are people who have got strong opinions on that one. I don't know if it's backed up by serious measurement. you and I were told about an article in 1967, September, I think it's Antennas and Propagation by J.E. Lindsay. I'm going to have to look that one up. I haven't done that one yet. How back to you, Mel. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, I'll tell you, years ago, I had a quad antenna. It's not better than a Yagi, but there are some advantages. A two-element quad can use a very short bone, 8 foot typically, and also no tracks. You feed each element independently with 3 feed lines. It worked very, very well. Very good antenna. Had it up for quite a number of years. Came down in a nice storm. I guess it's about 1974. I replaced it with a Bosley TA-33 tri-band, three-element tri-band, which was electronically more stable, but quite as good. And
you didn't continue to pursue cubicle quads because, although you may love the mechanical construction and the inexpensive materials, you didn't find them to be electrically superior when you replaced it with an antenna on the same band at roughly the same altitude. Is that about right, Rich?
The antenna itself is not electrically superior. What makes it superior is things you can do to it. Feeding it with 3 separate feed lines on 10, 15, 20 meters as opposed to using traps and one feed line. And on a small piece of property like mine, the boom is only 8 feet on a two-element quad. And like you said, a two-element quad performs like a three-element beam.
Now, I'll admit that the cubicle quad, you tend to stack wires of different sizes, different diameters, for the different bands, and you have separate feed lines if you desire, going to each of those cubicle quads, which are all sharing the same boom. There's nothing stopping you from making a Yagi, which has three driven elements stacked above each other vertically, on the three separate bands with three separate pieces of coax. There's nothing wrong with that concept to do it with a Yagi-like structure. Just no one has done it, it hasn't become popular, and therefore we think it can't be done. So I think you see what I'm saying. You could make three elements, three driven elements, very closely spaced, stacked on top of each other, with three separate feed lines, and three separate sets of directors out there. And therefore you could have three stacked Yagis on one boom, and the vertical stacking would only have to be a couple of inches. Back to you, Rich.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, Vic. That's very true. One reason I didn't go back to a quad, at least what I had mechanically, was very unstable. I ran into a situation, this was years ago when I could climb on the roof, and every year, we'd get ice or snow, wires would break, and then finally we had a big ice storm around 1974, and things totally collapsed.
Understand. So that's a matter of mechanical construction, and there's ways you could have made this quad more stable, just like you can make a Yagi much more stable. Okay, back to you, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2QIQ,
go ahead.
Yeah, I have a little question that I have. I've been trying a 10, 15, and 20-meter beam with Cushcraft MA-5B, and I was noticing recently that on the flat side of the beam, I haven't been getting very, very good performance, at least locally, and I got the idea that maybe if I put it in the vertical position, it would act closer to my vertical, because my vertical was giving me a good performance. So I put a motor on it, flipped it up to the other side, and I'm noticing now a very strange effect that I wouldn't expect. It seems like stations that are in closer are coming in better on the vertical polarization, and the DX stations that are further away seem to come on the flat side. Do you have any idea what's going on?
when you say vertical and horizontal, what bands are you talking about, Glenn?
That would be 10 meters, 15, and 20. And right now, the antenna is like a five-band beam. You know, it has also the 12 and 17 meters on it as well. And it's a shortened beam with hats and tats on it. And I've been trying, you know, moving in different polarizations. And it's only roughly about 35 feet in the air to boom.
If I understand correctly, you've taken something on the Lion's rotator, mounted it in the middle of the boom, and now the whole boom is rotatable so that you can make the antenna go from horizontal to vertical. Is that approximately what you've done?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And if I understand you correctly, the close-in guys sound better vertical, and the faraway guys sound better horizontal. That's for this season. As you see the sunspot change, and as you go to different seasons, that characteristic you've measured might not stay similar. And by the way, when you hear the close-in guys better vertical, were they vertical or horizontal guys, if you happen to know, Glenn, go ahead.
I was trying to figure that out, but unfortunately my data and experience now has been approximately one day. I was having so much trouble listening to some guys, and I wasn't sure why it was tuned. And I was beginning to think that it was improperly tuned. I checked the tuning and everything else, and that's why I put this rotator on it. But if I have more information, the longer I use it this way, I'll certainly let you know.
Yeah, the fact that the DX guys sound better horizontal on a particular day, you may discover that on every day it's not the same. Gather data a little bit more, for some little bit more time there, Glenn, and do come back and let us know what you find. It is my belief that as you gather more data on long-range signals, you're going to find which polarization is best is not always the same. I think you're going to find long-range signals that sometimes sound better horizontal than vertical. There's two things going on here simultaneously. Number one, the signal that goes through the ionosphere is going through multiple turns of Faraday rotation. That's just what happens when a plasma and a magnetic field mix together. You get Faraday rotation. The ionosphere is a plasma, and the Earth's magnetic field mixing with it is creating this rotation. And how much rotation you get is a function of what compass heading you're using. You're going to get a different amount of rotation to a guy that's dead north of you compared to a guy that's dead west of you because of the orientation of the Earth's magnetic field. It's a vector-like phenomenon. It's an E crossed H type phenomenon as far as the Faraday rotation is concerned. So the state of the ionosphere, which is a function of season of the year and state of the sunspot cycle, is going to make a difference in the amount of rotation you get. So I think when you gather more data, you're likely to find a greater randomization of polarization. So that's one of the things that's going on. Let me drop. The second thing that's going on is that a horizontally polarized signal and a vertically polarized signal give you a different takeoff angle. Horizontally polarized signal, the amount that reflects off the Earth experiences 180-degree rotation. Therefore, there tends to be a null directly on the horizon, and some number of degrees in elevation above the horizon is where the direct signal and the reflected signal off the ground come together for horizontal polarization. For vertical polarization, you don't get phase reversal on reflection. So for a vertically polarized signal, the good news is that you've got a lower angle of radiation out toward the horizon. Now, is that the best angle to bounce off the ionosphere to get the long-range signals with today's state of the ionosphere? There, I'm not sure. So it's going to take some more experimentation before we find out exactly what's going on here, Glenn. KT2QIQ for any other comments, K2RIW.
Yeah, at least, thanks for, at least, I don't feel like I'm insane now, because what really started me on this experiment was that I was using an R7000 vertical antenna, and I seemed to have a certain amount of performance. Then I went to the horizontal antenna, and I seemed to lose a lot of the stations that I was getting, and I expected them to be there, so I didn't have enough real estate to put up both antennas in the same area, so I got this idea of using the elevator motor on the boom to swing it back and forth. Now, like you said, I'm not sure if it's because I'm not speaking to the other people on their vertical antennas, and I'm just speaking to people on their horizontal antennas, and now I'm able to get the mix, but these are definitely questions I'm going to be asking on contact for the next couple of weeks.
You said the rotator and vertical on the boom. Do you mean that the rotator is rotating polarization of the boom? How about you, Glenn?
Yes, I do. It's rotating the polarization from the horizontal side to the vertical side. And the reason I'm calling it an elevator motor is because the Kenpro made by Kenpro, Yaesu makes a very similar one, and that is normally used for VHF beams to increase their elevation. So it's called an elevator motor, but I'm using it in the center of my beam. It's a relatively compact 10 through 20 meter beam to adjust the polarization, and I'm using a tail twister rotor to give me north, south, east, west.
Very good. I think I see the picture. That's a fun type antenna. And if you think that it's a little bit unique, and it might very well be, I think you should consider writing an article on that one after you gather a little more data. The combination of the article that I believe Mel is writing with reference to his loop experiment and the experiment that you're now doing, I think is about to start reawakening people as to what's going on with polarization. Because up till now, my goodness, has that been kept a secret. You get on 20 meters any day during the week, and you ask people how much is their signal rotating in polarization after it's been put the ionosphere, and I'll bet you 9 guys out of 10 will say, what in the world are you talking about? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Oh, yeah, I can tell you for sure that he's experiencing, Glenn, what I've been seeing now for quite a while now with the raised conditions on 75 meters by that receiving loop. Oh, I could, on a contact with my friend in Pennsylvania or one in the Massachusetts area or whatever, I could test that loop many times. I'm making changes in that loop over our, say, 1 hour contact period. Many times I'm turning the loop this way and that way and tilting it. Oh, gee, it's amazing how the effect of the atmospheric effect is very unusual at this time of the solar cycle. And in fact, we were on 10 meters today, and I was able to talk to my friend Howard at 2GOT in his mobile and follow him all the way from Brooklyn here to up to the west side, up to about 42nd Street or so, where he was headed to purchase something at, I believe it was B&H Photo up there. And this is very unusual that I was able to follow him with a six-element beam on 10 meters. And he's in a mobile and through all the canyons and everything like that on 10 meters. I mean, I've never had able to do this before on 10 meters. This is just unusual because, you know, you don't expect 10 meters to have this kind of coverage. It's basically, especially that big beam up there, that six-element 10-meter beam. It's a great DX antenna, but never was able to talk to even anybody in New Jersey with a dick over.
Very much fun talking to your buddy on 10 meters when he's mobile. When it comes to the fixed stations you're talking to, by the way, when a mobile moves, the fact that the best orientation of the antenna changes, very predictable and a little bit hard to correlate what's going on. But when you're talking to a fixed station in, let's say, Pennsylvania or Massachusetts, during the QSOs, roughly what is the rate at which the polarization appears to rotate? In other words, if I know you on many of the listening periods, you're fiddling with the antenna to find out which way does he peak up best. I would like to know, on average, Mel, how fast do the settings of your loop antenna change when you optimize the signal during reception? Are you resetting things every minute, every 10 minutes? Are you resetting things by 10 degrees or 90 degrees, if you know what I mean? How about you, Mel?
Yeah, sometimes, Dick, you can't keep up with it. It's constant in a flux that is constantly changing almost. It'll drive you crazy because you know, I'm missing part of the QSO all of a sudden, fading down, and I'm trying to get him back up there, and I finally bring him back up, and he's sending it back to me, and then I'm going back to him, and here we go again. It's some nights it's been unreasonable. I think that effect of the atmosphere twisting and turning that signal goes wild. I mean, it just doesn't stay put sometimes for more than a few minutes. It's very unpredictable at this portion of the cycle, which supposedly are somewhere on either on the bottom or approaching the bottom of the cycle. I mean, they can't even come up with a definitive on that right now.
Mel, give me a rough estimate. Your loop antenna that you're using most of the time in the shack, roughly how many pounds is the total weight? Go ahead. And that's not counting the mounting structure, just the antenna itself.
Oh, you mean the frame and the coax? No, weight, nothing. Maybe a pound, I don't know, maybe that much. It's a piece of, it was made, I bought some piece of wood at the Home Depot. They're three quarters by a quarter inch. You know, some kind of trimming, molding they use. It's like, what that thing is for, really. I don't know, I'm starting a bit there, so it makes it look like. And the piece of coax stretched around is a 58 variable condenser on it, so you can well imagine. Oh, definitely, that's the tripod. I got it on an old tripod, an old camera tripod. It surely weighs a heck of a lot more than the loop itself picked over.
Okay, here would be a fun experiment. You know that an automatic antenna tuner really contains a phase detector looking at the reflection coefficient at the transmitter side of the antenna tuner. So by looking at the magnitude of the reflected signal and the phase angle of the reflected signal, that tells the electronics inside, move C1 to the right and move C2 to the left, if you know what I mean, in order to reestablish the best impedance match. So an automatic antenna tuner is a little bit like a blind man walking uphill. The tilt on his feet tells him which way is uphill. By the same token, with a little bit of modification of your loop antenna, you could hook up a servo mechanism that automatically tuned its as, L, and polarization. It's the polarization I'm most interested in. I'd love to have you run an automatic antenna tuner that automatically tunes the polarization and runs a strip chart recorder or some other kind of a recording device, you know, a computer program where it gives you a printout. Wouldn't it be fun to see what is the optimum polarization for any period of time? Wouldn't that be a fun project to make an automatic antenna tuner? That's a real automatic antenna adjuster, Rebel. Boy, would that be a fun project. K2KEY. Hey, this is almost patentable, Mel. K2RIW.
Well, there's a lot more to it. Remember, I've got a second loop inside of the first loop. And what I do, basically, the reason I went to this configuration and all is because one loop, I actually pick up the noise. You know, I get noise sources from all of them, but some of them are so predominant that they're the ones that give me the trouble. If I get rid of that one noise source, they're the others I usually many times to live with. So what I do is I aim one of the loops at the noise source. I take that on, and I built that QRN squasher, you know, that combination that I take the two signals in from the two loops. I put it into this box that I built, and what I do is I adjust the phase. I have a gain control, and I have a phase control, and by manipulating, playing with the variable condensers on the loop, I can many times, if I listen on the regular outside loop, I may get noise levels 5, 7, 8, maybe 5, 9 at times, and many times I just can't make contact, you know, with anyone on 75 meters. But I put it through this contraption of loops and noise squashes and all this other jazz that I have, and I can take the noise level many times down to like S3. So an S5, 6 signal is perfectly copied. So it's not just that one loop I'm dealing with, Dick. You notice I'm dealing with a very complicated contraption here. And I do all my tuning by just watching the scope. I got a Oh, and that's another thing I added. I took the Collins 7584 receiver. I'm using the two receivers. So the Collins 7584 receivers would all just fed into